This lecture is on anti-market myths. And before I talk about some specific myths, I want to say a few things about Murray Rothbard's essay on the anatomy of the state that explains why so many myths exist. And also I want to say something about the role of Austrian economics here. You know, one of in von Mises, in Human Action and in his essay on theory and history, one of the points that von Mises made was that the study of history, by and large, is mostly a, sort of an ad hoc collection of facts with ad hoc interpretations that really, you know, might make sense today, but then 5 years from today, they won't make any sense at all because they're not based on any guiding theory. They're just sort of, you know, historians are sort of most, especially modern historians, are largely sort of collectors of mostly irrelevant and uninteresting facts. If you buy some of the big history books by the leading lights of the history profession that are about this thick, they're usually written by some Ivy League professor with 13 or 15 graduate students working for him who gather every known fact about whoever the subject is, Henry Clay or Alexander Hamilton, and they write this big, giant book that makes them seem like the expert on everything, but they are really are just you go through page after page after page of facts and just trivial stuff, and there's no guiding theme. But that's the usefulness of economics, Mises said, is that economics is a lens through which you can view historical events. Not every historical event, not everything is of that much economic importance. But that, von Mises said, is what gives economists an advantage over historians in studying history. They have this apparatus that has been worked out for hundreds of years by theoreticians and researchers and scholars, and especially the Austrian school approach, that can be very helpful in understanding what is going on in history. And so you ask different questions and you analyze issues very differently than just an ordinary historian would be. And then, of course, just Austrian economics itself helps you understand the thing that attracted me to it when I was a student is that, you know, I was an economics major in school, and one of the first things I learned as an undergraduate was that most of the economists were interested primarily in economic models, whether the models had anything whatsoever to do with reality. They were just interested in the models. And when I was in graduate school, I can remember there's a distinguished professor from Harvard, a mathematical economist, gave a talk, and it was supposedly about the hamburger market. And it was all just one big blur of mathematics, of course. So he just did his thing. It was mathematics on the blackboard for about 45 minutes, and it was supposedly about the hamburger market. And then one of my professors, Gordon Tullock, asked him and said, "Well, this doesn't seem to have anything to do with the real hamburger market." And the response by this the guy from Harvard was, "I'm not interested in the real world. I'm interested in my model." And that's mainstream economics in a nutshell. That's mainstream economics in a nutshell. So one thing that always attracted me to the Austrians was when I started reading von Mises and the rest, and Hayek and all the other, Rothbard, they had this compulsion to use their knowledge of economics, philosophy, history, political philosophy, to understand how the world works. That was their objective. How does the world work? How does the economic world work? The political economic world work? And they were just the opposite. They were just, you know, these models that had no relevance to explaining the world. It's just intellectual masturbation to all of them. It's just useless. And so, you know, when I was a student, I'm thinking, you know, why would I go to graduate school to be like one of these mainstream people and spend the rest of my career tinkering with mathematical models? You know, for what? To do what? And so that's why, you know, so a lot of the best research in economics, not just the Austrian school, but the Chicago school and other schools that is applied and historical and based in reality, is some of the very best research that I can think of that is out there. And it's not just the Austrians who have done this sort of thing. In the field of antitrust economics, for example, where I used to do a good bit of publishing, there's a great book that I think would have been a great doctoral dissertation from a student studying Austrian economics at the PhD level. It's called Winners, Losers, and Microsoft, and it's by Stan Liebowitz and Steve Margolis. And it's all, it's an application of good, solid, applied microeconomics to the whole issue of antitrust in the computer age, antitrust in the high-tech age, with a special emphasis on the old Microsoft antitrust case. And that's the sort of thing that I think would be great to see young Austrian school scholars looking for dissertation topics that do that sort of thing. And so... I wanted to start with that as sort of a background of why there seems to be so many myths out there. I'm going to talk about some of the specific economic myths that are out there that a lot of people buy. And of course, these myths have to be articulated by somebody. And that somebody is intellectuals of a certain sort. And so I want to read to you a small passage from Rothbard's his essay on... Anatomy of the State. And this is where he talks about the role of intellectuals in helping to prop up the state and statism. He says this: it is evident that the state needs the intellectuals. It is not so evident why intellectuals need the state. Put simply, we may state that the intellectual's livelihood in the free market is never too secure, for the intellectual must depend on the values and choices of the masses of his fellow men. And it is precisely characteristic of the masses that they are generally uninterested in intellectual matters. They're rationally ignorant, in other words. The state, on the other hand, is willing to offer the intellectuals a secure and permanent berth in the state apparatus, and thus a secure income and the panoply of prestige. For the intellectuals will be handsomely rewarded for the important function they perform for the state rulers, of which group they now become a part. And so the state relies crucially on intellectuals to help prop it up. In another place, Rothbard pointed out that even the biggest tyrannies in history, the communists in the Soviet Union, for example, Nazi Germany, the power of the government ultimately rests on a system of beliefs that is held by a majority of the public that rationalizes the state, that allows the state to exist. Because after all, any government, even the Soviet Union government, was only really a relatively a few thousand people ruling over many millions. And the many millions could have overwhelmed them and killed them all at any one time. There was just so many of them. And it was just a matter of them getting the motivation and the nerve. And so Rothbard goes through the means by which the state avoids this sort of thing. And of course, there's intimidation, there's mass murder, but that can be very costly and very risky. You know, people might think, well, if you murdered my neighbor, I might be next. Maybe I'd better go get a gun. And so that can be very risky. So it's much less risky to keep your power by brainwashing the population. That's why they always zero in on public schooling and that sort of thing. And so that's why the intellectuals are crucially important to spread the myths, lies, and superstitions about the grandiosity of the state and about the evils and failures of the civil society and the free enterprise system at the same time. But once the people no longer believe in these things, then the state is in big trouble. When our friend Yuri Maltsev, who has taught at Mises University in the past, defected from the Soviet Union in the 80s. He was a defector. He worked for Mikhail Gorbachev. I was one of the first among our crowd to meet Yuri way back then. I think Jeff Tucker was the very first one who ran into Yuri. And I asked Yuri back then, well, some of the biggest differences between your life in the Soviet Union and your life in America now that you're here? And he told me that no one in the Soviet Union believed anything the government ever said. But he says, when it came here, it seems like people believe just about everything the government says. There's a big difference in the two societies. And so, in other words, the U.S. government has done a much better job at lying than the Soviets did and creating this apparatus. Now, with regard to the economic myths that I want to talk about, I'm going to read one more paragraph from this essay, The Anatomy of the State, by Rothbard. So this is after he explains the role of the intellectuals and how crucially important it is for them to prop up the state. It's sort of a low-cost way of keeping the state in power and keeping the population sort of fat, dumb, and happy. And he says this: the increased use of scientific jargon has permitted the state's intellectuals to weave obscurantist apologia for state rule that would have only been met with derision by the populace of a simpler age. a robber who justified his theft by saying that he really helped his victims, he helped his victims, by his spending, giving a boost to the retail trade, would find few converts. But when this theory is clothed in Keynesian equations and impressive references to the multiplier effect, it unfortunately carries more conviction. And so the assault on common sense proceeds, each age performing the task in its own ways. So Rothbard defined what a lot of economists do as an assault on common sense, covered up with fancy equations and graphs and impossible to understand rhetoric. And one example of this, I mentioned this in my online class on the road to serfdom the other night, is that when I was in graduate school, the first semester, one of the books we had in my first semester of macroeconomics class was The General Theory by Keynes. And The General Theory is a book that I think to this day no one has understood. I don't think a single human being has ever understood what the heck is in The General Theory, because it's ununderstandable. It's impossible to understand what this is about, The General Theory. You go chapter after chapter after chapter, and it's an economics book, and there's nothing about prices anywhere, or markets, or market clearing prices, or anything like that. It's sort of an elaborate engineering scheme in there. And of course, Keynes himself once said in the German edition that his system would work better in a totalitarian society, because the slowness of getting laws passed, you know, tax cut, tax increase law, that can take a year or a year and a half, and so it's too clumsy. And so he said in the German edition that it would all work better in a totalitarian system. But that same semester when I was in graduate school, this was back when there still were a few dinosaurs left roaming the earth, so you had to watch yourself when you walked from the dorm to the classroom building in Blacksburg, Virginia, in the mountains of southwest Virginia where I was, that Keynes also published an article in one of the British journals. I think it might have been the Economic Journal in 1936. It was about a 20-page article, clear as a bell. You could understand perfectly what he had to say. And so I remember reading that article at the same time and thinking, why am I wasting my time just, you know, torturing myself with this stupid book, The General Theory, that no one... I'd already had an undergraduate degree in economics, so I knew a little bit about economics. What is this, General Theory? But the article, clear as a bell, very well written, and I understand perfectly what he was saying. And so that one of the things that taught me is it was possible for Keynes to say what he had to say in 20 pages. He didn't have to write this book. But all the graphs and the convoluted language and the pretense of a grand intellectual experiment gave this idea cachet. It gave a certain cachet, because really smart people, like members of Congress who had gone to law school, couldn't understand it. And if they couldn't understand it, well, this guy must be really, really smart if he can write a book that no one understands. And that's what Rothbard is talking about here. And that's the game. That's always been the game. And that, again, is one of the things that always attracted me to the Austrian school, because it was always exactly the opposite. When I started reading Henry Hazlitt and Mises and these other, and Rothbard, it was like they went to great pains to make things understandable, not to make things confusing, make it understandable. And one more anecdote I'll give you, that a classmate of mine in graduate school wrote a paper once, and she thought, she was really convinced, this is darn good stuff. This is going to be published in a good journal, which it eventually was published in an academic journal. And she gave it to one of the professors, and it was very well written, very well argued and everything. And he said, this is not good. This is not the official language of the economics profession. And so he rewrote it for her and made it very clunky and terse and sort of scientific sounding, as he said. And so you read it, and it was just awful. It sounded like the General Theory. But then she submitted it like that and got it accepted for publication right away. And so I did the same thing. I had an article, it was a term paper in one of my classes in graduate school, and I wrote it up. I had the same idea. I thought, well, this is new. This is a new thing. Nobody saw this. I'm going to submit it to some journals. And I submitted it to a couple sort of low-level economics journals, and it was rejected. And so I said, okay, I'll play the game. I'll say the exact same thing with a bunch of mathematics and graphs, but it's not going to say anything more. So I rewrote the thing with a big, big jumble of math and graphs, and I sent it to a much more prestigious journal, the Southern Economic Journal, and it was accepted without asking me to change even a comma, and then, you know, accepted as is, and it's published as is. And so that's the lesson I taught. The more obscurantist you are, the more likely it is you'll get things published in the economics profession. And so that's how a lot of these myths come into being that are out there. You know, like Paul Krugman is famous for saying, I don't pay attention to anything that doesn't come from a mathematical economic model, you know, whenever he argues with people like Bob Murphy or you know, responds to things like that. And that, of course, would rule out every one of his hundreds of New York Times columns, wouldn't it? Because there's no mathematical models in any of them. But that's the modus operandi. So let me turn to some of the myths. I'm going to start historically here with some of the myths that I know there's been a good bit of writing and research on from by Austrian economists, by myself and others. And the first one is the old myth of the robber barons. And this was the myth about the business people, the American big business people of the late 19th century, mostly the post-Civil War era, who started up the railroad. Not started up, but who developed the railroad industry, the steel industry, Wall Street finance, and so forth. And they were labeled as robber barons for many, many years. And, you know, and of course, for most of these men, just the opposite were true. They didn't rob anybody of anything. John D. Rockefeller, for example, made his money by producing refined kerosene and other petroleum products cheaper and cheaper and cheaper for 60 years. His company was founded in 1866, and that's how he made his money. His organization was so efficient. Even his biggest critic, Ida Tarbell, who wrote a history of the Standard Oil Company, used the phrase marvelous efficiency to describe the Standard Oil Company. And so, and this could not have been predatory pricing because prices fell for many decades. What businessman would say, here's my business plan. I'm going to lose money on purpose for 50 years, and then I'm going to drive everyone from the market, and then I'll make a killing, and then I'm going to raise the price to the sky. And that's the theory of predatory pricing. So it could not possibly have been that. It was just competition. Competition. And so, at least in that era, John D. Rockefeller was not a robber baron. He didn't rob anybody. He wasn't a baron. He grew up penniless himself. They all did, all these people. All the great so-called robber barons grew up. If you read a biography of James J. Hill, who built the only non-government subsidized transcontinental railroad, his father died when he was 10 years old. He had one eye. He helped raise his siblings. He worked like a dog for anybody who would hire him as a young boy and a young man. He became a clerk in the office of some business people in town in Minnesota, and he saved every penny. And he ended up by the time he got into his mid late 20s, he had enough money to go in partners and attract investors in a small railroad, and he turned that into it. The Great Northern, the Transcontinental Railroad, that turned out to be the most efficient transcontinental railroad built in the 19th century. So he was not a robber baron. He did not rob anybody. But there were real crony capitalists during that time, and sort of a prime example would have been in Leland Stanford, the founder of Stanford University. He was also in the railroad business, and he was a United States senator at one point. He was governor of California, and he used his political connections to have law passed that made it illegal for anybody to compete with his railroad inside the state of California. And so he gave himself a monopoly. And so he did rob people. He did rob people. He was a robber baron. But what the historians do is they lump people like Stanford in with people like Hill. And there's two different animals altogether. So there were rent-seeking scoundrels like Leland Stanford out there. And all of the government-subsidized railroads that were subsidized first by the Lincoln administration. In fact, Abe Lincoln, in June of 1861, before the first battle of the American Civil War, called a special session of Congress to get the ball rolling on building the government-subsidized Transcontinental Railroad. It was called the Pacific Railway Act. So the country is about to go into war, and there's a huge army building up in Manassas, Virginia, a couple of miles outside of Washington, D.C. And what was Lincoln's priority? Let's start raising money to build a railroad from Iowa to California. That was his priority, because they all assumed that the war would maybe be a couple weeks, maybe a month, and then we'll build our railroad. It didn't work out that way. And so they did do that, and those railroads, the Central Pacific and Northern Pacific, became notoriously corrupt and inefficient. They all went bankrupt at one point, compared to James J. Hill, who had this marvelously efficient railroad. And so, but anyway, that the myth of the robber barons really made the Progressive Era possible, I think, because the myth was perpetrated that all of these people were corrupt and dishonest and needed regulating by the government. And so, and of course, it was government interference that created the corruption. It was government subsidies that created the corruption and the scandal. The Crédit Immobilier scandal of the Grant administrations was related to government interventionism. That was not the free market. James J. Hill's Great Northern was the free market. And in his autobiography, he bragged that he didn't accept a dime from the government, not even land grants. He paid the Indians with cattle or money, whatever they could trade for rights away across their territory, whereas the government-subsidized railroads, they would call in the United States Army, and they would murder the Indians. And that was a way of socializing the cost of building the transcontinental railroads. And the chief engineer of the government's transcontinental railroads was a buddy of Abe Lincoln's. The name was Grenville Dodge. And after the war was over, he recommended that the government make slaves of the Indians and force them to dig out the railroad beds. And the government rejected that, and they preferred to kill the Indians instead, which they did. They waged a 25-year campaign of genocide against the Plains Indians. You can read about this. I wrote about this in an article in the Independent Review. The title of it is Violence in the American West, Myth versus Reality. It was 2 or 3 years ago. It was in the Independent Review. It's independent.org is the website. And so but Sherman himself, the General Sherman himself, said that as soon as the war was over, his attention turned to the railroads. And so they spent 25 years, and they ended up killing about as many as 60,000 Indians, and women and children included, and putting the rest of them on concentration camps that they called reservations. But it really was a veiled form of corporate welfare for the railroad industry. So that's where the intervention was. That's where the violence was. That's where the real violence was in the American West. It wasn't the shootouts at the OK Corral. It was the U.S. Army mass murdering Indian women and children for 25 years. So that's myth number one of the robber barons. Myth number two I'd talk about is the myth that in the late 19th century America, there was rampant monopolization because there was a merger wave in American industry. And so the relatively new steel industry and steel-related industries, the cement industry was kind of new, the railroad industry was, had been around since the 1820s, but it still was being developed at that point. And so the myth is that without antitrust regulation, we would have suffered from rampant monopolization and higher prices. Well, I mentioned this in my talk on competition monopoly the other day, and that what I looked into in my own research is, what industries, first, what industries were being accused of rampant monopolization? And I had a list. I put together a list of these industries. And I did gather data on the two most important things that the mainstream economists claim monopolies do. They restrict output and they raise prices above competitive levels, above free market levels. And as for output in these industries, this was a period of rapid expansion of GDP, the post-Civil War era, and price deflation as a result of that. So this was the good kind of deflation. Even though this type of deflation would still terrify Ben Bernanke, it was still the good deflation because it was caused by rapid expansion of supply. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with paying less for your next new car? That's a bad thing. Ben Bernanke thinks we should prohibit that at all cost, that you should pay less for groceries next week than you do this week. Oh, my God. End of the world. So GDP was growing from 1880 to 1890. Real GDP grew by 24%, according to the government's own statistics. But these industries that were accused of being monopolies by Congress, this is from the Congressional Record, their production grew by 175% on average during that time. So these were the most rapidly expanding, most innovative, most technologically advanced industries in the country, and they're accused of monopolizing. On prices, this was a period of price deflation, and the price Consumer price index fell by about 7% from 1880 to 1890, but the prices in all of these industries fell by more. You know, some of them, like steel rails, 53% decline, and for example, so some of them fell by seven times or more faster than the price level was falling. And so what I concluded in my research, this was an article, it's on the web, it's called The Origins of Antitrust by me, was that these were the most dynamic industries, most output expanding industries and price cutting industries for decades. And again, this could not have been predatory pricing because John D. Rockefeller, for example, would not have cut prices for 20 years with hopes of being able to raise them. That would be so foolish that it's unimaginable. And one thing John D. Rockefeller was never called was a fool. And so, fools don't make that much money and become the richest people in the world. And so that just didn't happen. Then the next myth that I've written about also is the myth of natural monopoly. If you take a microeconomics course and you get to the section on monopoly, there'll be the next chapter is on natural monopoly. And they'll tell you this story that with the advent of large-scale production and manufacturing, we had certain industries that achieved economies of scale, such as electric power, natural gas, water supply, because they have a heavy fixed cost. You have to build a power plant before you can get 1 kilowatt of electricity. So you might spend $1 billion before you have one customer. And the same is true for natural gas, water supply, and so forth. And so therefore, you have this rapidly declining cost per unit. You might have the graph looks like there's economies of scale. There's long-run average cost, and this might be 1 cent down here. And the story is that, one firm, one big firm will get there, will have the advantage and get there and get this level of output, Q1, and achieve that low cost, and everybody else will have higher costs. They'll all be up here. And so, and this really is sort of a version of the old predatory pricing story, isn't it? That one low-cost producer will price everybody out of the market and then will be a monopoly. It's the predatory pricing story all over again, which I call the unicorn of economic theory. That people talk about it, have been talking about it for a long, long time, but no one has ever actually spotted one. No one has ever actually seen a monopoly created in this way. And so therefore, the story goes, the wise and omniscient and benevolent government recognized this, it's reality, but they said, well, we want all goodness and no badness to come of this. So we will create the monopoly for you. We will not wait for this to happen. We will give monopoly franchises to business, to the electric power companies, because we want this low cost of producing electricity. But then we're not going to just let these guys charge the moon. They're not going to charge this price up here. In the public interest, we will charge some price over here. Like we'll call this the PP price, the price that's in the public interest. And this would be the monopoly price up here. And so that way we'll allow them to make enough profit so that they can grow their business and they can build new power lines and new power plant when need be. But we're not going to let them rip off the customers. So in the public interest, we will regulate them. That's the story. And of course, it's all pure BS. It never happened that way. And let me read you one quote. That I quoted Harold Demsetz, the UCLA economist, Harold Demsetz, about this. And he looked into the same thing. Was this actually happening? Were there these monopolies being created? He said the six electric light companies were organized in 1 year of 1887 in New York City. 45 electric light enterprises had the legal right to operate in Chicago in 1907. 45. Prior to 1895, Duluth, Minnesota was served by 5 electric lighting companies. Scranton, Pennsylvania had 4 in 1906. Before 1884, 6 competing companies were operating in New York City. Competition was common and especially persistent in the telephone industry in Baltimore, Chicago, Cleveland, Columbus, Detroit, and he goes on and on in all these cities. And so, in other words, this never happened that way. And so, and I did dig around to find out I was curious when I was doing my research, well, how did this happen? How exactly did they go about creating government-created monopolies? Because this theory came about after the fact. After these monopolies were created by governments, economists came around and created this ex post rationale, economic rationale for why they had to do it. They saved us from monopoly, although no monopoly ever was created like this. And so anyway, here's when monopoly did appear. In my younger days, before the internet, even when I used to be a library worm, I kind of enjoyed scrounging around libraries. I was kind of like saining for gold in the library, but you had to know where to look and what kind of books to read and what not to read and what to find. And I found this is one of the gold nuggets I found. I found a book that had a whole bunch of essays by Richard T. Ely, the founder of the American Economics Association, who taught at Johns Hopkins for many years, and this was at the Johns Hopkins Library. I found this book on the history of the Gaslight Company of Baltimore. And Richard T. Ely much of it was references to Richard T. Ely's research that he did at this time, or about this time. And here's how the franchise monopoly was introduced in Maryland. And also, all the other states just copied this. And I'll just read it to you. In 1890, a bill was introduced into the Maryland legislature that called for an annual payment to the city, Baltimore, from the Consolidated Gas Company of $10,000 a year and 3% of all dividends declared in return for the privilege of enjoying a 25-year monopoly. So in other words, there had been competition, plenty of competition in this business. And finally, the Gaslight Company of Baltimore finally bribed the government into having a law passed that said, okay, we'll create a monopoly and we'll share the loot with the government. We'll give you, $10,000 a year. And, you know, in 1890, $10,000, this is the pre-Fed era. So that's multiply that by at least 30, and it's a good chunk of money. And of course, the city government of Baltimore in 1890 was doing very little, and so that much $300,000 was a big chunk of money to them, the equivalent of $300,000, and 3% of all dividends declared in return. And I don't know how much money that was, but it was probably a good chunk of money because it established a monopoly in the gas light business in the entire city, and in return for a 25-year monopoly. And so once they figured out, aha, this is how to create a monopoly. You know, we tried to form private cartels. We tried to form, but there's always cheating. The cheating always broke down the private cartels. But when you got the coercive power of government behind you, then it'll work. And so that's how so-called natural monopoly was created. There's nothing natural about it. It was totally artificial, created by government interventionism. Another myth in there is there are many myths related to the Great Depression, and the first myth about that is the myth of Herbert Hoover. And the standard story is that Herbert Hoover was an advocate of laissez-faire, and the same thing is said about Alan Greenspan in today's world. But Herbert Hoover was supposedly an advocate of laissez-faire, and therefore his policies as president of the United States from 1929 to 1930 through 1932. Of laissez-faire, what caused the Great Depression? So a wheel fell off. John Maynard Keynes said, animal spirits. That's what you say when you have no idea what the hell you're talking about. You blame it on some animal spirits. People all of a sudden became like horses and donkeys and mules and lions, animals. They just went crazy. Animal spirits. And so, but the truth is, if you read any book about Herbert Hoover as president, what he did, he was a progressive, which means he was a big interventionist. He had public works spending that he tried that was 13% of the federal budget was public works spending, which is about double of what Obama's stimulus spending has been. He raised taxes pervasively, all kinds of taxes to pay for all of this. So they had huge tax increases, huge spending increases. He was a protectionist. He signed the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Bill of 1930 that started an international trade war that ended up reducing the volume of world trade by two-thirds in 3 years. Hoover was responsible for that. He socialized the capital markets with the Reconstruction Finance Corporation that for the first time put the federal government got the federal government involved in allocating capital as opposed to using the free market, the financial system, in allocating capital. And the Reconstruction Finance Corporation eventually spent $50 billion by the 1950s. There's a book about it by Jesse Jones, the man who ran it, and it's called $50 Billion. It's all about how much fun he had spending $50 billion of other people's money. But it was Hoover who started this. And so Hoover, and it was also Hoover who brought business leaders in, chief executive officers, and used threats and promises to them to get them to raise wages in a depression. And the economy was in a recession or a depression. And of course, the only way you could possibly save your job when there's a steep decline in consumer demand for the product that you're involved in making is to take a pay cut. You know, otherwise you're out of a job. If you raise wages in a recession, you price yourself out of a job. And so what Roosevelt did when he came in was just to codify everything Hoover was doing, because the minimum wage law and other types of laws that strengthen unions, that enabled unions to raise wages above competitive levels, that created additional unemployment during the Roosevelt era. But it was Hoover who got that started. And so in one of my books, I even quote Franklin Roosevelt's top domestic policy advisor, Rexford Tugwell, as saying, well, with regard to the New Deal, we really didn't do anything that Hoover didn't do first. We just sort of expanded what he did. It was Hoover who started farm boards, the idea of paying farmers for not growing food. And, of course, that restricted agricultural output. And when you restrict agricultural output, you restrict the usefulness that farmers have for farm labor. So you create unemployment among farm laborers. And, of course, Roosevelt expanded that to the manufacturing sector with the National Recovery Act and created massive unemployment in manufacturing as well as farming by trying to restrict supply and raise prices and to cartelize these industries. That was the whole idea of the first New Deal, is to create one massive system of cartels that would supposedly prop up prices out there. You know, so that was Hoover that started the idea of paying farmers for not growing anything. It reminds me of my old friend Walter Williams, the syndicated columnist who's been teaching at George Mason for many years. One of his columns was about this, and he read in a paper, I don't know, this is like 20 years ago or something like that, that Sam Donaldson, the old network news anchor, Sam Donaldson, he owned a sheep ranch in New Mexico, and he was making $200,000 a year for not raising sheep on his sheep ranch, It's the kind of government program that was started by Hoover and still exists in parts of the U.S. And Walter Williams, one of his columns was a letter. It was like a Dear IRS letter. And it was like, Dear IRS, he said, I too do not raise sheep, so where is my $200,000? Yeah, it's a good point, right? Why is Sam Donaldson? So at least we know what Sam Donaldson's wig is made of anyway now. Sheep. Wool, sheep rancher. So the Hoover myth is a myth then. It wasn't laissez-faire. Then comes the FDR myth, the myth that FDR got us out of the Great Depression. And in my book, How Capitalism Saved America, I quoted Newt Gingrich as saying, Franklin Roosevelt was the greatest American president of all time because he got us out of the Great Depression and he won World War II for us. And so that's Newt Gingrich. A PhD, Newt Gingrich, PhD. And so, but of course, FDR did not get us or anybody else out of the Great Depression. The official government unemployment rate in 1929 was 2.9%. By 1940, it was still in the 17% range. And so, it was still almost six times what it was at the beginning of the Great Depression, despite the fact that, that Hoover had spent tens of billions of dollars on so-called public works programs. But the first New Deal, now a lot of economists nowadays are finally catching on to what the Austrians said 60 and 70 years ago, that the first New Deal actually made the Great Depression worse because it was all based on creating cartels in agriculture and manufacturing. The National Recovery Act did that. It created price codes that propped up prices above free market levels. The Agricultural Adjustment Act paid farmers for not growing food and not raising livestock. And some economists have finally caught on to this. You know, Henry Hazlitt and the other Austrian economists wrote about this at the time, but I'll give you an example of how how mathematical economics can make you stupid, or the mainstream studying mainstream economics can make you stupid. There's an article that was in the Journal of Political Economy, one of the top economics journals, a couple years ago, by UCLA economists Harold Cole and Lee Ohanian. And these are real big shots in the economics profession. I think Ohanian was one of the editors of the American Economic Review. And there's a video now. You look up, Ohanian has a video now about this. So you can look it up on a YouTube video, which is very good, very good. But the point I'm making is these guys finally realized that they had what I think the scientific term for it is an oh shit moment. Oh shit. Like they've been teaching economics at UCLA for 30 years. And talking about how we can't understand why the Great Depression didn't end because the government spent so much money in doing it, and of course the mainstream macroeconomists call these all this government spending, they have all kind of weird names for it. Let's see if I can find one. Let's see. Well, injections. In one of my articles, I made an analogy between macroeconomics and Frankenstein, the Frankenstein movie, Young Frankenstein, because the language that Ohanian used in this article, and he said this, the weak recovery from the Great Depression is puzzling because the large negative shocks that some economists believe caused the downturn, you know, they try to shock Frankenstein into life with electric shock, including monetary shocks, productivity shocks, and banking shocks became positive after 1933. So how could the recession, the Great Depression, exist with all these government shocks? Okay, thus, according to the neoclassical theory, I'm quoting myself, the economy is somewhat like a prostrate Frankenstein monster, with economists playing the part of the mad scientist, recommending that the beast be shocked back to life with bursts of deficit spending. And so anyway, they go on and talk about injections and shocks. You know, that's the other word they use, injections. You know, like a big, think of a big giant needle, and there's Frankenstein laying there flat, and they put this big needle into him, and he comes back to life. That's how the language of macroeconomics. But Ohanian finally realized, this is the oh shit moment, wait a minute, I've also been teaching principles of microeconomics, and when I get to the chapter with my freshmen on cartels, what do I tell them? I tell them if you restrict output, you also restrict employment, because the demand for labor is a derived demand from the demand for the product that's being produced. And so they finally say, well, wait a minute, this is why the New Deal did not increase have a recovery, because the government was actually creating unemployment by trying to make the whole economy into one big cartel. And so they say that. However, It was not accepted by the profession unless they said this all in the context of an elaborate game theory model. They couldn't just say it in plain English. They had to make it up in a game theory model and publish it in the Journal of Political Economy, or no one would, like Paul Krugman would say, I don't believe anything that doesn't come from a mathematical model, even though Henry Hazlitt and others said the same exact thing 65 years earlier in much clearer prose. But that's how the economics profession works. So we do have some of the mainstream of the economics profession finally coming around 60, 70 years too late to understanding the myth that Franklin Roosevelt got us out of the Great Depression, or at least finally figuring out why they've been so befuddled their entire careers over why the New Deal did not end the Great Depression. Well, the next sort of a corollary myth to that is that, well, World War II did get us out of the Great Depression. Someone has probably mentioned this already this week, either Tom Woods or Bob Higgs. Have you heard this week, this explanation? Well, maybe not everybody has anyway. Well, that really is the linchpin of the Keynesian argument, that World War II, the government spending on the military during World War II, finally got the United States out of the Great Depression, because unemployment did disappear during the war years, from 1941 to 44, when the war began, there were about 5 million Americans unemployed. The unemployment rate was still 15, 16, 17% in 1939, 1940. And then within a year or so, this was gone. Well, as soon as the United States entered the war, it was gone. And so the Keynesians have long said, well, this proves Keynesianism. The massive government spending on military Keynesianism ended the Great Depression. But not really. Because, see, there's a difference between a man having a job, going to work, earning a paycheck, going home at 5 p.m., having dinner with his family, and a man being conscripted and enslaved, put on a boat, sent to Europe, and being blown up in a foxhole. Maybe it's just me, but I think there's a difference there between what happens to these two different men. But there are about 5 million unemployed, 11 million were drafted, and several million more joined the military, and many of them joined the military because they knew that if you waited to get drafted, you were much, much more likely to be ending up in the infantry, where there was a much higher probability of you be killed in the infantry. So if you joined, you'd have at least some chance of being a clerk somewhere or loading up boats or airplanes somewhere, but not on the front lines. And so it doesn't take a math genius to understand, well, you had 5 million unemployed and the government enslaved 11 million. Well, yeah, unemployment was over. That's why you see all these women in the factories, you know, they didn't have enough labor, so women had to find babysitters for the kids and go work in the factories. So you might, you know, I was a Civil War buff for many years. I have all these books on the Civil War, and I remember I ran across an old Look magazine from like 1943 or something like that, and there was the ex-wife of General James Longstreet in a World War II bomb factory. He was a Confederate general. He was Robert E. Lee's right-hand man in the American Civil War. And he was something like 80. He remarried and had a child at 80. And I actually met his granddaughter. I have personally met his General Longstreet's granddaughter. She's a very old lady. I met her at a Gettysburg battlefield at some event that I went to when I was a Civil War buff, and I went to these reenactments, things like that, and not great 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 granddaughter, but granddaughter, and her son who looks just like him. But anyway, so that's why you would see pictures like this in the magazines of women working in these bomb factories, because the men were all off in the army, and so there was no unemployment. But that's not what ended the Great Depression. And there's another piece of information that shows you what really ended the Great Depression is that. And Bob Higgs is great on this, and I don't know if I'm going to steal his thunder, or maybe he's already explained this. He might talk about it tomorrow morning or tomorrow afternoon, I don't know. But the year 1946, if you look up federal budget numbers between 1945 and 1947, the U.S. federal government's budget fell from $97 billion to $35 billion in absolute dollars. So there was about a two-thirds reduction in federal spending from 45 to 47 because of the demobilization of the military. 1946 was the single biggest year of economic growth in all of American history. The private components of economic growth, private consumption and investment spending, increased by about 30% in 1 year. No other year has been even anywhere close to near 10%. In any other year in all of American history. So this is Keynesianism in reverse. We had a massive cut in government spending by two-thirds in absolute dollars in 3 years, and the result was the most rapid economic growth, most rapid job creation by far, at least twice as fast as any other year in all of American history from 1789 to this day. And that's a fact that you never hear, because the Keynesian establishment doesn't want you to hear it. In fact, they lie about it. They lie about it. They include in the GDP statistic government spending, you know, C plus I plus G. And the G component nosedived, a huge reduction in government spending. So if you look at the whole number and don't disaggregate it, they actually say there was another depression in 1946. In some of the economic history books. But if you look at the real economy, the private sector, the sole area of job creation, it was the most successful year in all of American history. And so that's reverse Keynesianism. But that was whitewashed, and it was written out of the history books. Even though you can get these statistics like Bob Higgs does and other people do, and they're right there in front of you. And so so the truth is just the opposite of the great myth. Another myth is the myth of the independent Fed. And the Fed has never been independent, of course. But some of the things you read about the Fed by... Let me read you one thing that... Paul Samuelson's textbook was... the most biggest selling textbook in the world from 1948 until about the 1980s. And all the other textbooks were, for the most part, clones of Samuelson's textbook. And here's what he said from the 1989 edition of his textbook about the Fed. The Federal Reserve's goals are steady growth in national output and low unemployment. Its sworn enemy is inflation. If aggregate demand is excessive so that prices are being bid up, the Federal Reserve may want to slow the growth of the money supply, thereby slowing aggregate demand and output growth. If unemployment is high and business languishing, the Fed may consider increasing the money supply, thereby raising aggregate demand and augmenting output growth. In a nutshell, this is the function of central banking, which is an essential part of macroeconomic management in all mixed economies. And so it's sort of a magical stabilizer of the economy. And all the other books say the same thing. The second biggest selling book was the one by Campbell McConnell, who said this: because it is a public body, that is, because it's government, the decisions of the Board of Governors of the Fed are made in what it perceives to be the public interest. The Federal Reserve banks are not guided by the profit motive, but rather they pursue those measures which the Board of Governors recommends. The fundamental objective of monetary policy is to assist the economy in achieving a full employment, non-inflationary level of total output. So blah, 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 blah. That's the nonsense that generations of college students were taught about what the Fed does. It serves the public interest by stabilizing the economy. And why? Well, because it's an independent body, they say. These authors, these students were taught, it's independent of politics. And as the late Milton Friedman used to say, that a government institution that is independent of politics is as likely as a cat that barks like a dog, or vice versa, a dog that meows like a cat. There just ain't no such animal out there. The chairman of the Fed is appointed by the president, for goodness sake, and he has to be okayed by the Senate. That means whoever is appointed in advance has the permission of the Senate. So there's a whole body of literature on the politicization of the Fed. I guess in this day and age where it's so blatant, where the Fed is just printing up money and giving it to Goldman Sachs. Here's a trillion. It might seem like you don't even need to argue that the Fed is not independent, but the academics still do. The Paul Krugmans of the world still do make the case that even if it's not, they say it should be, as though that's at all possible. But in one of my old articles called The Myth of the Independent Fed, it's on the web somewhere, I cited a whole bunch of academic literature that shows that with the change of presidents over time, the different Fed chairmen, or sometimes the same Fed chairman, if President, let's say President Nixon wanted rapid economic growth, Arthur Burns gave him 10% growth in the money supply. Then Gerald Ford comes in. He wants slow economic growth because price inflation is worrisome. Arthur Burns gives him 2% growth of the money supply. And so you had very volatile changes in the money supply growth depending on what the boss wanted. And that was been true. The literature I cited began with the Eisenhower years and went all the way up to the 90s, up to Greenspan, showing that this has always been the pattern. Because after all, if you want to be reappointed, you have to do what the boss wants. And if the boss wants easy money, you darn well better give him easy money, or else you're not going to be reappointed as Fed chairman. And so it always has been a political institution, despite things that are said. Maybe the final myth I'll talk about is the myth of the libertarian Fed. You know, some so-called Austrian economists have made this argument by defending the Fed. Like Jeff Hummel was one of them. I think David Henderson has been a big Fed defender ever since the Great Recession of 2008. And other people associated with the Cato Institute have done this. But I don't see how anyone could call the Fed libertarian in any way. First of all, it's a central planning agency run by politicians and government. Its main objective has become price control. The control of interest rate is a price. And so price controls, you know, what libertarian would advocate price controls? And but the Fed does more damage than that. Here's a partial list of some of the things the Fed regulates. I'm not going to read all of these, but this is a partial list from a Fed publication called The Structure of the Federal Reserve Board. It's online. It's a Fed's own publication. It regulates bank holding companies, state chartered banks, foreign branches of member banks, edge and agreement corporations, state licensed branches, agencies, representatives of office of foreign banks, national banks, savings banks, non-bank subsidiaries, thrift holding companies, financial reporting procedures, accounting policies of banks, business continuity, consumer protection laws, securities dealings, foreign investment by banks, and on and on and on. And there's, you know, there's more on this page. The next page has more stuff that the Fed regulates. And so just the Fed regulates all aspects of financial markets, let alone the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Office of Thrift Supervision, and you know, and a dozen or so other government agencies. But nevertheless, we had people like when the Great Recession hit, there's a mainstream business writer named John Steele Gordon who wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal about the cause of the crash. And I'm going to quote him. The cause of the crash, 2007, 2008, was, quote, the baleful influence of Thomas Jefferson and his anti-central banking views that still live on today. And he said, in the person of Ron Paul. So, you know, Jefferson was in a famous debate with Alexander Hamilton over a national bank. Jefferson was the anti-bank guy. Hamilton was the pro-bank guy. And so here we have the year 2008. The Wall Street Journal is saying the cause of the current crisis is these horrible ideas critical of central banking that began with Thomas Jefferson are still out there, and it's that damn Ron Paul that is spreading them, and that's why we had a crash in 2008. So if you want to be a Wall Street Journal columnist, write bullshit like that. that's how you become a Wall Street Journal columnist. And then that wasn't enough. The Wall Street Journal dragged out Henry Kaufman, the Wall Street stockbroker. And that's always a very reliable source of information, isn't it? A stockbroker. And he wrote, well, this wasn't the Journal. This was the Financial Times. So you have the two biggest financial newspapers in the world, the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times. He said, you know, what the problem was, libertarian dogma had led the Fed astray. That's it. You see, Alan Greenspan knew Ayn Rand in 1960. Alan Greenspan is chairman of the Fed. Therefore, libertarianism caused the crash of 2008. Who could argue with that? And that's probably, though, the prevailing view in universities, that there was some sort of explosion of greed urged on by people like Alan Greenspan that caused the crash. Of course, greed has always existed on Wall Street. There's no reason to believe that it just popped up all of a sudden. And I don't think there's any reason to believe that it greatly expanded all of a sudden. What would have caused this ignition of greed all at once in the year 2007? But that's what you get. Even in most business schools that I've been around and talked to people and other faculty members, that's pretty much the accepted wisdom, that there was an explosion of greed. And so like I said, you know, you're all laughing because you understand something about economics and you can see through this easily. So that's, but you're a unique group. You know, you're here studying economics in Austrian School Economics, but many of your peers will hear this from some professor who is very well dressed like Tom Woods, not like me. And it becomes very believable if you listen to these people say these things, if you don't study economics, if you don't have the background to. So keep at it. And I think we're about out of time. And I think it's martini hour now, isn't it? The next 2:30, 3:30. Okay, that's all we're going to do.